National Security This Week, a weekly look at American national security issues. And now, your host, John Olson.
Good morning, everyone. It's Wednesday, May 4th, and you've joined us for National Security This Week. May the 4th be with you. We get together here on KYMN Radio every Wednesday at 9 a.m. to discuss national security, and we're joined by guests from our local area, from around Minnesota, and from across the nation to help us explore American national security. We're turning to the continent of Africa for today's show. The 54 nations of Africa comprise some 1.4 billion people. The land contains extraordinary natural resources and some of the most iconic species of animals on the planet. Competition for the riches offered by the African continent goes back centuries, and some of the worst behavior by the European nations, and later our own nation, towards African people and the environment are well documented. The post-colonial era in Africa was initially a turbulent time. In the 60s and 70s, armed coup d'etats happened on average every 55 days somewhere in Africa, and over 90% of African nations experienced a coup attempt. For a time, it seemed such upheavals in power had come to an end, but lately that trend has changed, perhaps in line with the renewed struggle between democracy and autocracy that has begun to punctuate international affairs. With us today is a guest who has studied history in Africa and who also understands the security challenges inherent in the region and why affairs in Africa matter to the United States. Dr. Mark W. Dietz is Assistant Professor of African and World History at The American University in Cairo, Egypt. His research and teaching focus on 19th and 20th century West African history, especially in the Senegambian region. Dietz moved to Cairo in 2017 after obtaining his doctorate in African history at Cornell University. Dr. Dietz embarked on his academic career after retiring from the U.S. Marine Corps in 2010. In the Marine Corps, Dietz flew the UH-1N helicopter in Somalia, the Persian Gulf, and Okinawa. He also flew the VH-3D and the VH-60N with Marine One, Presidential Helicopter Squadron, serving Presidents Bill Clinton and George W. Bush. Dr. Dietz spent much of his second decade of military service in the diplomatic corps, serving as the Marine and Defense Attaché to West African countries such as Senegal, the Gambia, Guinea-Bissau, Cape Verde, and Mauritania. In Mark Dietz's final tour in the Marine Corps, he returned to his undergraduate alma mater, the United States Naval Academy, to teach history and to serve as the varsity wrestling officer representative. A native of Beloit, Kansas, Dietz is married to Taryn Redeker Dietz from Kerrville, Texas. They have six children, three of whom he and Taryn adopted from Ethiopia in 2007. Dr. Mark Dietz, welcome to National Security This Week.
Hello, good morning, John.
Good to be with you.
I know you're back in the States right now for your daughter's graduation, so thank you for taking the time from your vacation to join us on the show.
Absolutely. It's my privilege.
So, Mark, you and I go way back. We were history majors together at Annapolis, and we graduated in the same class, the great class of 1990. We also served in diplomatic tours in our respective careers, but you definitely have far more experience in that field than I do. I only did one tour. You did five. Let's talk a little bit about your diplomatic postings to get us started today, a little background on your knowledge and expertise of the West African region. What did you learn about West Africa serving as Marine and Defense Attaché and Senegal, the Gambia, Guinea-Bissau, Cape Verde, and Mauritania? That's a lot of diplomatic postings all in kind of the same region.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you, John, for the opportunity to be with you today. Those are quite a wide variation of postings. For most of that time, however, I was actually posted to the U.S. Embassy in Dakar, Senegal, where I was also diplomatically accredited to the Gambia, Guinea-Bissau, and Cape Verde.
Okay.
The Mauritania posting was actually a separate posting. You know, for one thing, I think I came to appreciate was just the diversity of these, you know, the five different countries that I was diplomatically accredited to at different times. All of them, well, actually, you know, it was only Senegal and Mauritania that was a former French colony where I was able to use my French language abilities. Of course, the Gambia spoke English, so that wasn't a problem. Guinea-Bissau and Cape Verde were former Portuguese colonies, and so the official language there was Portuguese. Hmm. And so, you know, I always found myself kind of in a not only a different language setting, but a different culture, and coming to appreciate those differences, and yet also the connections between those different countries in West Africa.
Say more about that, some of those connections between those countries across the region. I obviously, there's some cultural differences that date back not just to the tribal time frame, but the colonial time frame. But what are those connections today?
Yeah, so, I mean, probably the most significant connection that has been there over centuries has been that of trade. In fact, the Cape Verde Islands were actually uninhabited, as far as we know, until the start of the Atlantic slave trade in the 1500s, right? So certainly the Portuguese had begun to explore along that Senegambian coastline in the 1400s. But and then there was the development of a slave trade along that West African coast, but it didn't actually go across the Atlantic until 1525. And if you take a look at the map and look at where the Cape Verde Islands are located, they're 450 kilometers west of the westernmost tip of Africa, which is in Dakar, Senegal, or just north of Dakar. And So this became an important transshipment point, and you have actually the development of an entire nation of people who came mostly from the sexual unions of Portuguese and other traders and many enslaved Africans. Mm. Okay. Yeah, that's just such a unique and different place, but it's kind of situated like right out there in the middle of the Atlantic, closer to the African coast than perhaps the Americas, but still very much in kind of the midst of what will become the development of that transatlantic trade, where, you know, they're trading in all kinds of things in addition to enslaved human beings. You know, they're trading the flora and fauna that becomes known as the Columbian Exchange, things like palm oil eventually are going to be traded a lot, and you know, things like manioc and tomatoes and all these things that become a part of the Columbian Exchange.
Yeah.
So anyway, yeah, those trading relationships are very important. And those have also resulted in, of course, economic relationships that, to bring it up to the present, are very important. All of these countries that I've mentioned are members of the Economic Community of West African States, which is very important and powerful sub-regional organization in West Africa.
And that's abbreviated as ECOWAS, right?
Right, that's right.
Yeah. So your research and teaching focus seem to sort of mirror your lifetime experiences as a diplomat. Is that why you focused on this area when you pursued your doctorate in African history at Cornell?
Yeah, it absolutely is. So I arrived in Dakar in January of 2005 to start serving as the Marine attaché and eventually the defense attaché. That was 1 month after the signing of a peace agreement between the Senegalese government and the Movement of Democratic Forces of the Casamals, which is a separatist movement in the southern part of the country. And so it became a part of my job to start going to these meetings with senior Senegalese defense officials and, armed forces officers, to start talking about not only our own security assistance, but also how they were going about trying to realize a real and lasting peace in the Casamance, which is that southern part of Senegal. If you look at the geography of Senegal, it kind of makes a backwards C with the Gambia kind of like a finger sticking in the middle of that C, sort of a lock and key kind of geographic body, if you will. And so that southern part, the bottom part of the sea, is the region known as the Casamance, which, like I said, had been trying to secede from Senegal since 1982. That was the beginning of this armed conflict. And so, yeah, it became a part of my job to go to these meetings with other government officials, other members of the international community, to meet with some of the rebels as well, from different factions of the MFDC, which is kind of the acronym that they go by. It's a French acronym. In any case, one of the things that I found was really interesting and kind of strange was that it seemed like nobody ever pulled out a map at these meetings. And, you know, for one thing, as a former military officer, and second of all, as a former pilot, you know, I like maps.
Right.
Maps make me comfortable. I just kind of thought it was strange that, you know, in talking about these particular territorial claims of this separatist movement, nobody ever pulled out a map. And there was always just kind of this assumption that we all knew exactly about the claims that we were talking about. But what I began to hear over time was the development of a discourse, or kind of, you know, a repetition regarding questions of identity in certain spaces and places of the Casamance. And so, to make a long story short, these spaces and places became kind of the framework of my PhD dissertation at Cornell. I have one chapter entitled The River, another chapter entitled The Rice Field, another chapter entitled The Forest, and then the last two chapters are entitled The School and the Stadium. And so I look at each of these social spaces and I look at the histories that made each of these social spaces a place of where there was a certain identity claim being made in those spaces and places in ways that were thought to be different from the rest of the Senegalese nation, which was, Senegal's 95% Muslim. It's the largest ethnic group is Wolof. And so, you know, it's kind of the Senegalese nation, the Senegalese nationalism, if you will, is kind of founded on this Islamo-Wolof identity. And this part of the country that I was looking at was one of the few places where Catholic missionaries had some impact. And so it's not a Muslim-Christian thing solely, because actually most of the people in the Casamance are still Muslim, but there was some Christian influence there. And of course, there's a different ethnic group that's kind of at the center of that rebellion, even though it's not solely tied to ethnicity. So anyway, you know, I got to Senegal and started studying this conflict to prepare for these meetings and things. And I just found it fascinating. It was so complex. Every time I thought that I had it figured out, I would pull back another layer of the onion and discover something new underneath that I hadn't understood before. And so it just became really intriguing, and I was hooked.
It's sort of like the old adage that the more you learn, the more you realize how little you actually know.
That is so true. That has been so true for me in this line of work. Yeah.
So Mark, you were a career officer in the United States Marine Corps. How did your time as a Marine inform your desire to earn that doctoral degree? Obviously, education has both been important to both of us as career military professionals, Why was it important to you to pursue that doctoral degree?
Yeah, I mean, I was looking at a number of options when I was looking at retiring from the Corps in 2010. And this is one of the things that I was considering. You know, I had done the math and kind of figured out a budget of kind of what I would need to live on to make it through graduate school, a wife and six kids. You know, I mean, I couldn't have done it without my military pension, right? Yeah. So this is not a career path that that most of us military retirees undertake after retiring from the military. But I figured out that even though we weren't going to be rich by any means, you know, that we could we could make a living that way in combination with my military pension and the graduate student stipend that I would be receiving from Cornell. I mean, I don't know how many of your listeners know this, but you can actually get paid to go to graduate school and get a PhD, depending on the school and where you go and what kinds of assistance that that you qualify for. Anyway, this was one of the things that I was looking at, and you know, I applied to a number of different schools, and I was a little shocked that they actually let me into Cornell. I'm pretty sure they evidently they didn't take a very close look at my record at Navy, at the Naval Academy. But no, anyway, yeah, that was a life-changing opportunity for me. Yeah. And so, yeah, I made the plunge, all the way. I think that my advisors at Cornell, first of all, I was not the first one there. I went there and I worked, especially on African history with, Judith Byfield and Sandra Green. And there had been an Air Force officer or veteran who had preceded me at Cornell. Her name is Michelle Moyd. She now teaches African history at the University of Indiana. And so anyway, I think that that Sandra and Judy like had an appreciation already for what veterans, kind of the dedication, the maturity that veterans would bring to a graduate program. You know, the sort of determination as well, because there are ups and downs. And you, as you can imagine, 7 years of graduate school, which is what it took me to get my PhD, there are ups and downs. And I certainly had a few colleagues from my graduate cohort who threw in the towel, decided they'd had enough for one reason or another. But yeah, I saw it as a challenge and saw it as my job and as my profession and kept going even through the tough times. But, you know, there's another part. We have these 11 Marine Corps leadership principles in the Marine Corps. The very first one is know yourself and seek self-improvement. And, you know, I think that's partly the reason that I became interested in an academic career, but also because I came to realize, I think you mentioned this earlier, John, I came to realize how much I didn't know about the world from serving overseas. And I became interested in becoming a foreign area officer in the Marine Corps. And, you know, I know you have a similar program in the Navy and serving overseas with my family. I saw that as an opportunity. That began an attitude and a process of lifelong learning for me. And the more I learned about Africa, the more I realized that I didn't know and that I could never know. And I learned that history can be very selective and that you cannot actually master it all.
No.
But I sure have enjoyed the opportunity to try to master historical knowledge of this one little corner of the world, you know, called the Casamals in southern Senegal.
Yeah. So for our audience, you're listening to KYMN Radio, AM 1080 and FM 95.1. This is National Security This Week, and I'm your host, John Olson. Our guest today is Dr. Mark Dietz, who teaches at the American University in Cairo, Egypt, and we're discussing the spate of coup d'etats that have hit West Africa in the last couple of years. So, Mark, let's get into our core discussion for today, the spate of coups in Africa. According to my information, these are the coups that have happened in the past couple of years. There was a successful coup in August of 2020 in Mali, a failed coup in March of 2021 in Niger, another successful coup in Mali in May of 2021, a successful coup in Guinea in September of 2021, a successful coup in Burkina Faso just this year in January of 2022, and a failed coup in Guinea-Bissau on February 1st in 2022. Maybe we could start with the two coups in Mali. What was the catalyst for those coups, both of which were supposedly led by, I think it's Assimi Goïta? Is that how you pronounce the coup leader's name?
Yeah, that's how I would pronounce it.
Okay.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely.
What do you think led to those coups?
Oh, my. That is a complex question. And I guess part of my answer would depend on how far back, you know, do you want to go? Of course, there are the kind of the near term proximate causes. But we can go back millennia to some extent with this. But I would probably start for, you know, kind of an overview with all of these West African coups. I would probably start with the Libyan revolution following the murder of Muammar Gaddafi in 2011. You know, if you want to, we could also go back to the post 9/11 jihadist movement that the U.S. Military was involved in fighting, or at least trying to counter, especially after 9/11.
Yeah.
You know, the U.S. government became very concerned with counterterrorism issues all over the world, and Northwest Africa was no exception. And so there became some concern with the Salafist group for preaching in combat, which, or the GSPC, to use the French abbreviation, which was a transnational jihadi movement that came out of Algeria at the time. You know, the thing that kind of got the attention of people in the defense establishment after 9/11, I don't know if you remember this, but there was like a group of 34 German hostages who were taken hostage in the Algerian desert. I mean, these were all tourists, right?
I do remember that. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. And so that was one of the things that was in the news for a while. And a couple of other sorts of kidnappings of Europeans and various Westerners by these terrorist groups, and so the realization that something needed to be done about security in these kinds of areas in kind of what becomes known as the Trans-Sahara, and so the U.S. government started this effort that was originally called the Pan-Sahel Initiative. Eventually, the name was changed to the Trans-Sahara Counterterrorism Partnership. And in this partnership, the U.S. government was working with all of those Sahel countries, so Mauritania, Mali, Niger, and Chad, and then Algeria and Morocco as well, and Tunisia to the north, Senegal in the west, and then Nigeria in the south. And so, you know, it's partly kind of from this this initiative, and I would argue to some extent the fact that there's such a focus on this area that some of these transnational terrorists begin to want to align themselves with Al Qaeda to kind of like have the prestige of the Al Qaeda brand in their name. And so what was then the GSPC then changed their name to Al Qaeda in the Islamic Maghreb. And then eventually that group is going to splinter into many different groups is going to lead to political instability in Mali. And then this one of the first coups in Mali in 2012. So the French intervened after that coup and sent an expeditionary force into Northwest Mali to begin working against these transnational terrorist groups, these jihadist groups. And this kind of initiates the beginning of kind of an antagonistic relationship with Mali. Of course, most Malian officers, as a former French colony, have received their military training from France. But this was, you know, kind of the beginning of this relationship that was originally, you know, France intervening yet again in one of its former African colonies. Eventually we're going to see other actors and more local issues become a part of this. So issues such as these antagonistic relationships, for example, between herders in the region and farmers. So it wasn't just a question about like Islamic jihadism, right? There are more of these sort of local factors that become a part of this. Other members of the EU become interested in this. Of course, the United States had been interested in sort of partnering with France to develop governance in these areas that were considered, quote unquote, undergoverned, mm-hmm. you know, to kind of help get some sort of governance, some kind of control in these areas, especially in the northern part of these countries, which are the center of the Sahara Desert.
Yeah.
And so eventually we're going to see the Russians get involved here.
I'll have a detailed question for you on that a little bit later.
yeah. So anyway, all of that comes together. I mean, we could also go back to the colonial conquest and talk about the subsequent failure of these post-colonial states to incorporate those distant northern regions of the Sahel into the colonial state. But just suffice it to say for now that, you know, the Sahara is kind of a classic undergoverned space. And even with all of the technology that we have today, that basic characteristic of this space that we're talking about in terms of kind of a geostrategic viewpoint has not changed.
Yeah, and if you look on a map, the Sahara is an absolutely enormous space.
Yes, it is enormous. I think that most academics and government officials and, you know, observers kind of consider it like another ocean, right?
Yeah.
So North Africa is kind of like this coastline, and actually Sahel, that word in Arabic, it literally means coast.
Okay. So I did a little research for this show, as you can probably imagine. If I'm going to get on a show with somebody who's got a doctorate in African history, I better know a little bit about the history. and I did find that just since 2010, there have been over 40 coup attempts, either successful or attempted coups in Africa, and some 20 occurred in West Africa and the Sahel. And that 44% of those – actually, no, let me say the vast majority of the coups that have happened in Africa have happened in former French colonies. So, just the recent ones that I brought up just a few minutes ago, except for Guinea-Bissau, which is a Portuguese colony, as you talked about, the rest were French colonial holdings. Am I reading too much into this commonality, or does history tell us to be mindful of the precedents and conditions left behind by the French government in the post-colonial era? Is that having an impact here, or is it something else?
Well, John, you're speaking to a historian. you were my fellow history major at the Naval Academy, so you can imagine what my answer to this question is going to be like. But look, you're right to an extent. Francophone Africa has a not so impressive reputation regarding coups. In fact, between 1958 and 2008, most coups in Africa occurred in former French colonies. So I would say that the history of decolonization in the African continent is not exactly the same in the Francophone countries compared to the Anglophone countries. And I think part of that reason, part of the reason for that is because the French kind of tried to hold on a little bit. You know, they had different ideas about how to decolonize in Africa. Originally, there was going to be actually this sort of imperial Greater France, somewhat like the British Commonwealth, but with stronger ties and more formal structures that would be maintained. So instead of like getting, you know, straight out independence, these African countries would be a part of this larger French Union. And that kind of, so that was something that it comes out partly of the history of the Algerian revolution and, you know, the war for Algerian independence. But then also through the efforts of the French to kind of hold on to their empire to an extent, right? And so one of the things that I think was important to French power in the Cold War period and in the post-colonial period was this former empire of theirs. You know, this claim to being a great power in terms of the UN and the international community and the Security Council, which is tied to this old empire, and most of it's in Africa, right?
Yeah.
So you can see how that's an important issue for the French, and why even after independence, they continued to tinker, or they continued to kind of, you know, to stay involved, to kind of keep their hand in the pot to some extent. In the post-colonial period. So like I said, you know, I think you're right about that point. On the other hand, I view the different forms of European colonialism in Africa largely the same.
Yeah.
I mean, they're basically colonial states that were created for the express purpose of economic exploitation and resource extraction from these colonies in Africa,
yeah,
with the veneer of quote unquote the civilizing mission. This idea of la mission civilisatrice, where the French would come in and teach their African colonies, the members of these African colonies, how to speak French, to study French history, to take on French ideals, to some extent, the Catholic faith. Although, you know, France has always had this sort of frenetic relationship between the Catholic Church and the French state.
Right.
So, in general, I kind of view all of these colonialisms as sort of the same thing. The other thing is that these are all French colonies because most of West Africa was colonized by the French.
Right.
So, you know, most of Southern Africa was colonized by the British.
Right.
Should we ascribe all of the racial problems in Southern Africa to some inherent aspect of British colonialism? I mean, all colonialisms were racist and they were all extractive. So to me, you know, I think there's very little evidence for some kind of claim to being more responsible or beneficial or effective at colonialism by between the British or the French or the Portuguese or any of them. And yet I think that we can also recognize that, you know, French colonialism and especially the process of decolonization had some particular characteristics that affected how we got to where we are now.
Yeah, and to further that just briefly, we know that there have been French military presence in portions of West Africa and areas of the Sahel, even I think a European task force, both focused on sort of the counterterrorism mission. And there's been some backlash now amongst the governments in those regions saying, enough is enough, you guys need to go home.
Right.
Would you care to comment on that at all?
Yeah, I I mean, you can kind of see where these West African countries are coming from to an extent, I think, you know. I mean, can you imagine having the British continue to intervene and kind of meddle in American affairs? I think that's kind of unimaginable to us. And yet, of course, I mean, to some extent, that happened. I mean, look at the War of 1812.
Yeah, that's true. That's true.
I think as Americans, we can also understand why these West Africans are kind of fed up and they're saying, okay, enough is enough.
Yeah.
Time for you to go.
Yeah.
To the French, you know,
granted, they invited the French in initially, but they've been there an awfully long time and they haven't really made a huge difference. So time.
Right.
To go.
Right. Well, I think that's key is that, this impression that, the French intervention hasn't really been that effective. It hasn't really stopped the spread of this jihadist movement, which, you know, by the way, all these coups that we're talking about, the two coups in Mali, the coup in Niger, the coup in Burkina Faso, they're all related to this question of in dealing with these jihadi movements in the northern part of the country.
Yeah. So for our audience, you're listening to KYMN Radio, AM 1080 and FM 95.1. This is National Security This Week, and I'm your host, John Olson. Our guest today is Dr. Mark Dietz, who teaches at the American University in Cairo, Egypt. And we're discussing the spate of coup d'etats that have hit West Africa in the last couple of years. So, Dr. Mark Dietz, let's discuss why these coup d'etats matter to American national security interests in this final segment of our show for today. The U.S. has embassies in nations all around the world. We maintain those embassies to ensure we have a diplomatic presence to foster better relations, both for economic opportunity and for national security interests. West Africa is an important part of the world. In fact, I think we can state without hesitation that this century we will see Africa become vitally important for global economic growth, and that competition for access to the natural resources on the African continent may lead to hostilities, both inside Africa and maybe even among nations jockeying for access to those resources. Why don't you tell us why coup d'etats in West Africa are most concerning to you as a retired Marine Corps officer, career or somebody with a significant military diplomatic experience and as a doctorate in African history?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think from a U.S. national security standpoint, John, coups create instability, that often create an outcry for U.S. involvement in the international community from a humanitarian standpoint. But also they perpetuate the weakening of African nation states. Of course, that's never what the coup leaders say is their objective. But in reality, we know, and we know this from history, right, these coups lead to this weakening of African nation states that was begun during the colonial era and carried into the post-colonial era as gatekeeper states, as described by Fred Cooper of New York University. And what Cooper means by these gatekeeper states is that the key to power in the colonial state and in the post-colonial state has been who determines what comes in and out of the country. Okay. So from an export import standpoint, whoever has the say on what's coming into the country and what's going out of the country are the ones who have the power here. And the reason is because, of course, originally that was a colonial relationship. So again, going back to what I was talking about earlier in terms of economic exploitation and resource extraction. I guess the point that I want to get to vis-a-vis these coups is that the coup leaders and the government officials, state leaders, they're not responsible to the taxpayers of that country. You see what I'm saying?
Yeah.
They're responsible to the colonial businesses, or the post-colonial sort of these like neo-colonial economic relationships, mm-hmm. Where the people with the capital to make decisions about these kinds of things, they're actually either outside of the country, or this sort of indigenous elite with very important economic and personal relationships outside of the country. This is what I think has led to so much instability. And I concur with a study, by the way, from the Africa Center of Strategic Studies at National Defense University, that part of what is so concerning about these coups is that Western countries have basically come to acquiesce to them. We're much slower to condemn coups recently. And if I could, I'll just posit a personal anecdote here. I mentioned one of the places that I was accredited to during my time as a military diplomat in West Africa was in Mauritania. And that was actually in 2005. I arrived in Nouakchott that was kind of a temporary posting for me to provide some coverage as the military attaché in Mauritania. And I arrived in the country on August 2nd, 2005. I had an army sergeant who was going to be working with me there. And he said he'd been in the country a while. And he said, you know what, sir, I'll pick you up tomorrow morning at 7:30. Well, he called me at 7 and said, I'm going to be there a little earlier because there's a coup underway. So this is my first day on the job. And like my official work day hasn't even begun yet. And I'm already responding to a coup. So this was welcome to like political military relations in Mauritania. I think what's interesting, though, is to kind of look at that coup in 2005. And I start getting in touch with my sources and kind of reporting back to Washington on what's going on with the coup, so on and so forth. But I've come to realize that there was a very different reaction to the coup in 2005 than there had been in 2003, when, by the way, there was actually a firefight that took place outside the walls of the U.S. Embassy in 2003 in Mauritania for that coup. But for this coup in 2005, people were driving up and down the main street of Mauritania, cheering and honking their horns. And this coup took place when the president was out of the country to attend the funeral of King Fahd in Saudi Arabia. Mm. And so basically the military took over and told him not to come back. But there seemed to be, I think because the embassy in 2003 had kind of condemned the previous coup leaders too early to by some judgment anyway, there was a hesitancy to do that in 2005, and I think you see kind of the continued development of that with. Where a number of American officials have made this calculation, wondering if it's actually in the U.S. best interest to condemn the coup leaders, right? Yeah. So this kind of raises the question, is there such a thing as a good coup?
Right.
if you do have a corrupt, autocratic, violent head of state, anti-democratic, who perhaps might even be inimical to U.S. interests. Is that a coup that we want to go ahead and let that happen and not condemn it right away? These are the kinds of questions that I think U.S. officials have begun to answer themselves. And yet, I think overall that, in the long term, that's a loss. That's counterproductive for U.S. interests. And maybe I'm a little old-fashioned in believing that The promotion of democracy is something that is in the long-term interests of the United States. But I think that's kind of taken a hit.
Yeah, that's very insightful, Mark. Thank you for sharing that. So as defense attachés, we were often tied to security assistance programs in the countries to which we were assigned. What can you tell us about the security assistance programs you oversaw in your postings in those West African nations? Why is delivering military training, maybe even selling weapons to host nation militaries, and maintaining regular high-level dialogue between military leaders so important for American security interests in the regions in, say, West Africa?
Great question. The first thing I'll say is that I think one of the most important programs that we coordinate as military attachés is the IMET program. You remember this, John, from your days as the naval attaché to Finland. The opportunity to invite these foreign, international military officers to the United States to come study with us, whether it's at the Naval War College, whether it's the Army Command and General Staff College, the creation of these relationships to what is actually happening on the ground later on, I think is so important. And by the way, it also allows us the opportunity to help these foreign military leaders view the world a little more from our point of view, from kind of an American approach, an American perspective. And I think that is invaluable. That's not to say that we're going to, somehow convert these foreign military officers into like full-fledged Americans that view the world exactly the way we do. In fact, quite often, this question, as a former diplomat, the struggle is for us to be able to see the world the way that they do.
Right.
But look, bringing them to our military educational institutions, I think is huge. So that's one of the things. But
can I just comment on that? So that's probably, I think to take that a step further, it helps professionalize their military. And reinforces the idea that we hold dear, and that's the subordination of the military to civilian political control. And I think that also helps establish sort of the stability that you were just talking about in our previous topic, where coups are probably not the optimal way to change governments, to change political directions in countries around the world. Is that a good way to frame that?
That's right. That's absolutely right. We have come in for some criticism on this. I believe that Goita, the coup leader in Mali, is a graduate of one of our security assistance programs. Whenever there's a coup and there's a coup leader who has some kind of ties to, education, military education, in the United States, that's often brought up. But I think he also had military education from France. a number of the Muslims have also traveled to Saudi Arabia.
Yeah.
So, I don't think that we need to start like blaming all of these external actors necessarily. But the point is that it's an important program, and it really does give us at least an entrance to having some kind of influence with these very important leaders in these foreign countries.
Yeah.
In addition to the IMET, the International Military Education and Training, I oversaw a few other programs that I thought I could mention. One, which was really important in the post 9/11 world, was that Trans-Sahara Counterterrorism Partnership. That I mentioned earlier. And this was providing education and training for military officers in those 9 West African countries that I mentioned. But the other thing that we were working on was also getting them to share intelligence.
Mm-hmm.
And that was a tricky, really tricky question, especially when some of these countries have been antagonistic in the past like, for example, Algeria and Morocco, you know, right. these two Northwest African neighbors with a history of, let's just say, an antagonistic relationship.
Right.
So that was, you know, that was kind of a diplomatic challenge, but and I don't think that we succeeded necessarily in all those things, but nevertheless, I would like to think that you know, we made a difference to some extent. On the other hand, here's one of the things that I often wonder about, John. You remember that movie, Field of Dreams?
Yes. If you build it, they will come.
If you build it, they will come. Exactly. Exactly. And so I kind of felt like we took this, what had been really more of an internal Algerian threat, the GSPC, mm-hmm. and made it into this transnational terrorist group that became then Al-Qaeda in the Islamic Maghreb.
So, you know, by recognizing it and taking it on head on, we gave them prestige that they wouldn't have otherwise had.
Exactly. Exactly.
Yeah.
So like, I'm not trying to, like, you know, undermine or destroy this program, the Trans-Saharan Counterterrorism Partnership. But there's this aspect to which, yeah, I often felt like we kind of helped give these jihadis credibility in a part of the world that they wouldn't have had, and in ways that they would not have had credibility
yeah.
before.
Well, Mark, you're tapping into a topic that we've addressed many times on this show. That's sort of the policy strategy match, having a comprehensive understanding of what it is you're actually trying to accomplish with the strategy you enact to achieve your stated policy objectives over a long period of time. It's sort of that art and science of statecraft, how we use the tools of national power, diplomacy, knowledge and information, economic power, and military power. I do have one last question that I want to ask of you. We only have about 7 minutes left. We know China is pushing hard for access to natural resources across Africa. That's part of their Belt and Road Initiative. And Russia, too, has invested themselves on the African continent, mostly in security assistance by deploying Wagner Group Russian mercenaries in various places in Africa to assist governments potentially friendly to Moscow's positions as they put down internal dissent. From your vantage point as a career officer in the Marine Corps and as a serving military diplomat and a student of African history, you know, we study histories because, you know, the old adage, those who don't know history are doomed to repeat it. How do you see the next 25 years shaping up for America's national security interests in Africa? I'll give you 5 minutes.
Okay. Sounds good. I'll see what I can do.
All right.
yeah, there's a lot of people who've referred to what is taking place now in the African continent as kind of the second scramble for Africa.
Mm-hmm.
Because or they're calling it kind of a second Cold War, framing it between the United States and our Western allies and China, and kind of its Eastern allies to some extent. But China is not Russia, even though they're often on kind of you know, the same side to some extent, but. They certainly have both been involved in Africa in huge ways. I think 10 years ago or so, and actually they've been doing this, I think, on a biannual basis, where the Chinese invite all of the African heads of state to come to Beijing for a meeting. And pretty much every single one of them goes, John. I would like to think that if the president of the United States invited all 55 heads of state from Africa to come to a meeting in Washington, D.C., that they would all come, but I'm a little skeptical. Okay. But they all go to China.
Yeah.
Okay. Part of what African countries like about Chinese investment in their countries is that the Chinese don't get on them about their human rights record. You know, they come in, they're very kind of matter of fact about what they want to do. A lot of it quite often is bringing Chinese labor to Africa to realize some of the investments that they're that they've been making in the African continent, whether it's building railroads, infrastructure, port facilities, whatever the case may be. This creates a lot of jobs for Chinese. Right. And so it doesn't always create a lot of jobs for people in these African countries, though. So, you know, I think that African leaders are kind of seeing that for what it is and realizing that it's a double-edged sword with Chinese investment. Of course, they also consider, you know, Western or American involvement kind of in a similar way, because we do have these expectations that we often make very clear about human rights and about good governance and so on and so forth. So I'm actually, in spite of these sort of continuing external pressures, I'm kind of an Afro-optimist. Recently, there was an article published by a scholar at UCLA named Alden Young on this kind of Afro-pessimist versus Afro-optimist debate. And I'm an Afro-optimist because I think that the histories of colonialism and the Cold War were so destructive to African societies, where, again, like the people who are pulling the levers, those gatekeepers that I talked about earlier, they're often from either from this kind of expatriate elite or actually from the outside, right? Mm-hmm. And so I feel that that now that that's over, that African countries are having more of an opportunity to kind of make their own decisions and to, you know, to follow their own initiative, especially with the younger generation. But, you know, this new Cold War between China and the United States does not bode well necessarily for this optimistic future, but I'm placing my hope in this younger generation of Africans who's more educated, and thanks to technology and social media, they're also more connected and more aware of what's going on in the rest of the world. So I'm signed me up as an Afro-optimist for the next 25 years.
All right. Well, Dr. Mark Dietz, unfortunately, we've come to the end of today's edition of National Security This Week. Thank you so much for joining us today.
It's been my privilege. Thank you so much for inviting me, John.
What do you have on your plans before you head back to Cairo?
Well, I have a daughter who's graduating from college in Pennsylvania. So,
all right.
So we're going to be celebrating that that graduation. And, of course, Mother's Day, which is also the same day as my wedding anniversary. So lots of things to celebrate this weekend in the Dietz family.
Good enough. Well, congratulations on all of those things.
Thank you.
So, folks, that closes this week's edition of National Security This Week. We're on KYMN Radio, AM 1080 and FM 95.1. I'm your host, John Olson. Thank you for joining me today. Look forward to sharing time with you again next Wednesday morning at 9 a.m. Thank you for listening to National Security This Week here on KYMN Radio. Have a great finish to your week, everybody. Take care.
You've been listening to National Security This Week, a weekly show looking into issues of American national security with the host, John Olson. Listen every Wednesday at 9 a.m. for National Security This Week.
The team at Witt Brothers Auto Care would like to thank